coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody and happy Tuesday night. Hope everyone is doing well out there despite the madness in the world. I have the great pleasure tonight. You know, we are coming up on our 200th episode very, very rapidly. This is episode 195. We have a few upcoming events that we will be on the road for, and that's the first part of this episode tonight. Is we'll be talking about one of those events and the events that progenerated what this event is about. And I'm very, very happy to have been invited to go to Washington, D.C. over 9/11 this year to the Turning the Tide 9/11 Justice Conference. There is going to be an amazing cadre of speakers. And one of the organizers and people behind this amazing event, everybody, is Mr. Richard Gage. Please welcome San Francisco Bay Area architect Richard Gage, AIA member of the American Institute of Architects and founder and former CEO of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He now leads the charge for a new World Trade Center investigation, along with his courageous wife, Gail, at richardgage.org. And there is his website, everybody. Welcome to the show, Richard Gage. How are you this evening, sir?
Doing great, Chris. Thank you so much for having me. This is going to be awesome to bring the explosive evidence of the three World Trade Center skyscrapers to your audience.
It's going to be an amazing conference, number one. I cannot wait to be there. This is a topic, Richard, that, I mean, I was a youth minister for a long, long time, and this was something that I was a youth minister, and we spent months talking with our classes. I knew people whose family were in the trade centers, things like that. So it's something that's very near and dear to my heart to this day. I knew people who went and volunteered for cleanup and help because they were firefighters. And the truth behind this, the number one, it's one of those, it's a prime example, going through and watching the links that you sent, things like that, hearing the scientists and the other architects just say, like, this is not science. It's not science to say that we didn't look for explosives because we didn't think there were any explosives used. So we didn't look for them. So there's no evidence of explosives. Yeah, that's not science. That's not how that works. And despite what you may believe politically, everybody, given the wealth of evidence that Mr. Gage presents scientifically from an engineer's point of view, from an engineer's perspective, from what the other presenters at this amazing conference are going to be presenting, there is a wealth, not a dearth of evidence, sadly, that at the very least our government let things go like Pearl Harbor and let something happen. At the very worst, something horrible, horrible happened here, Richard, that, it, you know, and we're going to be getting into things tonight, folks, like nanothermite and stuff like that. And before you go, hey, wait a minute, there's no nanothermite. Never forget, we have the always trusty knowledge vault. Feel free to stop on by curiousrealm.com/knowledge, everybody. Go to scientific studies and documents, the newly added document right up top is the actual patents for nanothermite. So there's the abstracts, there's everything else, but just ground zero, literally, before we go any further tonight, nanothermite exists. It's a thing. And there is evidence for it found. Now, Richard, how did you come to the world of studying this from just being an everyday architect and engineer?
Well, I had never heard any alternative theory as to how these towers came down until March 29th, 2006 when I heard on the radio David Ray Griffin, who was being interviewed by Bonnie Faulkner on KPFA's Guns and Butter. He had written he's written now 14 books on the subject of 9/11 truth. They're extraordinary. Wow. All of them groundbreaking books. But here he was talking about, you know, a third tower that came down on 9/11. What are you talking about? I'm an architect. I would have known of a third tower that came down. I didn't. And he's talking about molten metal dripping from the ends of the beams. He's talking about the explosive testimony of at the time, 118 first responders in the 12,000 pages of testimony found by Professor Graham McQueen. And I'm going, what do you, witnesses of explosions, many before the towers came down? What are you talking about? Well, he was speaking the next night at the Grand Lake Theater, and I had to be there. I had to find out if any of this was true. The place was packed, 600 people.
Wow.
I couldn't even get in. I had to go home and listen to on the live stream. Man, I was shocked at what I learned. I took this to this information after a couple of months of researching it and talking to people. You know, the guys in the office thought I was nuts, but all 14 of them came when I bribed them with pizza, and they sat and they watched. And at the end of that 45-minute presentation, which I'm going to give you guys today,
please,
they all raised their hands. Oh my God, you're right. These are controlled demolitions. That was my first 14 architects and engineers for 9/11 truth. Today there are 3,600 demanding a new investigation.
Wow.
Signed on to the petition.
Wow. And you know, I am one of those people that I would love to believe the best, Richard, but when the evidence stacks up like this, when things like this just line up, it's one of those you can't, it's hard to deny it. It's hard to deny the points that you bring up. And even to the point, because there was a hypothesis that came out a few years ago about, well, the whole presence of thermite and explosions is explained by the actual aluminum bodies of the airplanes and the condensed heat of the jet fuel around them. And the sprinkler hitting that is what caused a thermitic style explosion. And that's why you find thermite, things like that. But you wouldn't find nanothermite like this. You wouldn't find nanothermite that is unignited.
Well, you don't find thermite at all in aluminum water explosions.
And we'll
put that theory to rest
real
quick when you see all the evidence. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's go ahead and get into meat and potatoes, Richard. Let's let people start hearing this information for themselves, because it really is one of those that at this point in time, and we are not that far away from this situation, folks, but at the point in time in which this happened and now, it's very important for us to be able to look back, be able to peel things back, and be able to look at them with the proper light that Mr. Gage really does provide here. So please, Richard, go right ahead.
Well, thanks. I just want to encourage everybody that this does take courage. It's not
That's right.
something to do lightly. Yeah, we're looking at technical evidence, but the implications of this evidence challenge our own worldview. They can make people very angry. They did me. They can make people upset, scared, because the conspiracy that evolves here out of the awareness that these buildings were destroyed by explosive demolition and 3,000 people murdered and manipulating the world, America along with it, to go to war, a $6.5 trillion global war on terror.
That continues.
Invasion of two countries. What?
That continues.
Yeah, it continues. Yeah, that was just the beginning.
That's right.
This is incredible. So all of these speakers, including Eric Lawyer of Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, are going, and family members like Matt Campbell from in the UK, who's getting a new inquest into his brother Jeff's murder in the North Tower. And then John Kiriakou will be there, CIA whistleblower. Kurt Weldon, former congressional representative. He and Ron Johnson have been interviewed by Tucker Carlson about 9/11 in large measure. Ron Johnson is a sitting senator, the chair of the subcommittee of the Senate. He has subpoena power. He's called for a new investigation. He's the keynote speaker of this conference.
Awesome.
That's never happened before in the history of the 9/11 truth movement. We've never had a congressman. We've had a couple of former congressmen, including Dennis Kucinich, who's back talking about this. Tony Schaefer, whistleblower from Able Danger. Ted Walter and John Cole, a civil engineer who's answered the question, where did the towers go? Asked by Judy Wood, where did the towers go? So John Cole answers that question, where the towers went, with his new video presentation. Refuting her thesis of directed energy weapons. Pierce Morgan and Dr. Aaron Good, that's just half of the speakers.
Wow.
I'll be giving the presentation in Washington, D.C. that you're going to see now. And I mentioned this third tower. We're going to start with that because people don't understand that this tower, most people don't even know anything about it. Architects and engineers. It's the third worst structural failure in modern history. And yet it's relatively unknown. So we have to, it should have been the most studied structural failure ever.
Absolutely.
It's about 47 stories north of the North Tower. And, it's the tallest building in most of our states, though it looks dwarfed here by the Twin Towers, which are the tallest buildings in the world. No plane hit this building. That's one of the reasons we're looking at it. It came down anyway. And it wasn't by the damage that hit it when the towers came down. You can see the red area here. That is damage that has been noted by NIST, and you can see it also in the photograph. Was not a significant factor in the building's collapse, according to NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who is tasked by Congress to explain these collapses to the American people. Well, let's look at that collapse. Here is the building from the north side. The east penthouse is on the upper left. It comes down in an isolated event.
Yep.
And 6 seconds later, this happens overall to the building, straight down, uniformly, symmetrically, into its own footprint. So we got to ask ourselves, wait a minute, have I seen this before? Yeah, you've seen it before. The old hotels in Las Vegas.
Yep.
But let's listen to Shyam Sunder explain this.
What we found was that uncontrolled building fires caused an extraordinary event.
No audio. Thanks, Shyam. He says fires brought this building down. Well, yeah. Fires, let's look at those fires. These are the worst fires that we have any video or photographic evidence of in the building. They're few, they're small, and they're scattered. And they're out. They're burned out on the floor of interest to NIST, where they say the collapse initiation began.
Mm.
Well, how could they be expanding these long-span beams, pushing this girder off of its seat on this column if they're burned out on that floor an hour before the building collapsed?
Yeah.
They're supposed to be raging, as NIST claims in this computer simulation, at the time of the collapse, causing the thermal expansion that pushed that girder off of its seat. That's their whole collapse initiation theory. So they've got huge problems of credibility right off the bat. Not to mention that no steel frame fire protected structure has ever collapsed in history due to fires. It has never happened, not before 9/11 or after 9/11. Well, what has brought down these buildings? We mentioned controlled demolition. Let's look. On the left, a series of known controlled demolitions. Building 7 on the right. Is there any similarity? Is there enough similarity to warrant an investigation into the possible use of explosives? Especially since this fire, the official cause of this building's collapse, has never in history brought down a steel frame fire-protected structure ever. It should have been the first, if not the only, serious hypothesis examined by NIST, and yet it was relegated to a set of very frequently asked questions on their website about 10 years later. So we have to ask ourselves then, is there any features of controlled demolition? Beginning with, is there a sudden onset of destruction? Let's listen to Dan Rather.
What you're seeing are high shots.
Oops.
Now
we have audio on our end.
Oh, you do?
Yes, I do, sir.
Oh, I'm glad you told me that. Let me listen to Dan Rather.
And what you're seeing are high shots. Now, here we're going to show you a videotape of the collapse itself.
Describe that.
Now we go to videotape the collapse of this building.
It's amazing.
Amazing, incredible, pick your word. For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
What was that, Dan? Destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down deliberately? He's never used these words. After 9/11, you know, it's good that he told us on TV what he thought, but we've never even seen the collapse of this building with two exceptions. After 9/11, is there a straight down symmetrical collapse? It's as if they wanted to just make this go away. Do we have a straight down? Yeah, let's look from West Street. Pretty straight down, pretty symmetrical.
Yeah.
How do you do that? You have to take out all the core columns, followed about a second later by the perimeter columns. Any deviation in that pattern, the building will begin to tip over. You don't want that to happen. Did these fires have that level of precision? Unlikely. Really, really, like a trillion to one, unlikely. Those charges don't go off. You can get major problems like this in an intended controlled demolition, or this, where it goes down halfway and it begins to just stop. And somebody has to go back in that building and set those charges off. Not going to be me. Now, did these fires have the capability to bring this building straight down? No. If you don't get it just right and the building is damaged on one side, like NIST claims in the northeast corner, the building will begin to tip over. See, that's the whole point here. Column 79 was taken out by a series of heat-induced structural thermal expansion causing floor 13 to fall on 12 and 12 on 11 and so on. And then the column breaks and then that instability travels all the way up to the roof and then over across this football field length building in a matter of seconds. It's just so ludicrous what they're suggesting here, especially when you look at how fast it came down.
Yeah,
David Chandler, physics teacher, clocks it at free fall. Now, wait a minute. What does that mean? That's as fast as a bowling ball falling out of the sky. The bowling ball has no resistance under it. This building had 40,000 tons of structural steel resistance.
Yeah.
It's not going to just disappear so the building can fall as fast as a bowling ball, which NIST admitted in their final report 7 years after 9/11 when they finally finished it and everybody who knew anything about it forgot about it. Well, what does that mean? If the building came down that fast, that means that not one of these 82 columns gave any resistance to this building's collapse on several floors. Not one. Well, where did they go? These fires take them all out at once? No, not going to happen. But what does seem to be happening is the total dismemberment of the structural steel frame, We had a moment resisting steel frame structure that's all of a sudden in a pile like a house of cards, completely dismembered. Buildings that fall naturally, in this case due to earthquakes, they fall over the path of least resistance. The columns and beams are not severed one from another. The concrete is not pulverized to a fine powder. Can these fires do that level of damage to these buildings? No. So what can? Well, explosions can. We know that. Controlled demolitions are explosions. Are there any witnesses of explosions? NIST says no. There's no witnesses of explosions. Here's half a dozen just right here. Here's Daryl, a medical student, interviewed that evening.
We were watching the building, actually, because it was on fire. The bottom floors of the building were on fire. And, you know, we heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. Turned around, we were shocked to see that the building was... it looked like there was a shock wave ripping through the building, and the windows all busted out, and, you know, it was horrifying. And then, you know, about a second later, the bottom floor caved out, and the building followed after that. And
yeah.
We got a sound of a clap of thunder, a shock wave ripping through the building, the windows busting out, and then the building coming down. Interesting. Kevin McPadden, former Air Force medic, what does he say?
You heard explosions, like boom. It's like a distinct sound. It's not like when the compression, like boom, 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 like floors that were dropping and collapsing. This was boom, and like you felt a rumble in the ground, like almost like you wanted to grab onto something. That, to me, I knew that was an explosion. There was no doubt in my mind.
Okay, that's very helpful. How about
I was standing like two.
How about Bill Rosati? What did he see?
I was standing like two blocks away, and all of a sudden I just seen a big flash, and then I seen the building coming down, and I just seen people just running everywhere.
A huge flash of light. Interesting. We're going to see if there are other witnesses of explosions locally here within two blocks of Building 7 in the late morning of 9/11. After the towers came down.
Yeah, here's one of the guys. He can tell you I'm okay, all right? Here, hold on. You want to call your mother or something?
Interesting. NIST says no witnesses of explosions. They claim to have interviewed 116 first responders. They missed all of these.
Yeah.
What about the experts? Here's Kamal Obaid in... Berkeley, one of three dozen structural engineers, signed on to the petition demanding a new investigation. A localized failure in a steel frame building like World Trade Center 7 cannot cause a catastrophic collapse like a house of cards without a simultaneous and patterned loss of several of its columns at key locations within the building. Does that sound like something the fires are going to do? Well, this got the attention of one of the top forensic structural engineers in the country, Professor Leroy Halsey, who examined it. He says, God, we're going to find out how these came down. After all, there are plenty of other similarly designed.
That's right.
High rises. Yeah, they could all come down.
Yeah.
And yet, by the way, none of the codes were changed for structural steel after 9/11. Nothing that could prevent a fire-induced thermal expansion causing the collapse of a steel frame building. Firefighters still go into these buildings every day. So Professor Halsey and his team provided competing software programs to corroborate each other, and they did. One of the things they found out, if this building would have been damaged on the east at column 79, the northeast corner, it would have fallen over. Okay, well, that's helpful. What did you have to do to get it to behave like it did in a building? The actual video of the collapse is in the center. So on the left, Professor Halsey, he had to take out all the columns in the building. Well, that's what NIST tried to do, but they couldn't even do it in their reverse engineering attempt. They released 400 structural steel connections failing every second. And the building actually begins to tip over. Yeah. So they stop it after 2 seconds into the global collapse. Don't want to show us what's going on there. So the essential findings of the University of Alaska, fire didn't cause the collapse of this building. The temperatures were not high enough to cause the weakening of the steel framing. Thermal expansion did not result in a loss of support for the beams and girders. The collapse of this building was a global failure involving what? The near simultaneous failure of all the columns in the building. Not a progressive collapse, as claimed by NIST. So, we've got some real credibility here with this report that's been given now to every congressman in power over the last 15 years.
Yeah.
So we got to look and say, well, what really could have brought this down? Well, is there any evidence of the kind of heat that accompanying these explosions could make them for some real problems, right? Well, FEMA themselves found in their metallurgical examination of the steel, including at Building 7, never before observed eutectic reactions causing intergranular melting capable of turning a solid steel girder into Swiss cheese, like we see in this piece of World Trade Center 7 steel.
Yep.
Rapid oxidation, sulfidation, liquid iron, that's molten iron. That's 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit iron. Sulfur formed during this hot corrosion attack on the steel. They actually documented all this. What did NIST do with this when they took over the investigation in 2004? They threw it out. But the New York Times had called it the deepest mystery uncovered in the investigation. But NIST omitted it completely. And the author of the FEMA report, Jonathan Barnett, fire protection engineer, says steel members in the debris pile appear to have been partly evaporated in extraordinarily high temperatures, he says. But it takes 4,000 degrees to evaporate steel. Well, where are we getting these temperatures? Where are we getting temperatures capable of melting the material pouring out of the crab claw excavator? We know the temperature of molten steel and iron by its color. We're exceeding 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit here, more than twice the temperatures that most office fires ever get to, and well past the worst case mathematical temperature used for fire tests, 1,830 degrees. Even jet fuel doesn't burn hotter than 600 degrees, according to this engineer and this group that says 600 degrees maximum open air burning temperatures of jet fuel A1. Well, this is interesting. What can create those temperatures? Maybe thermite can. Let's see.
An incendiary used by the military, thermite is a compound of iron oxide and aluminum, which when ignited sustains an extreme heat reaction, creating molten iron. In just 2 seconds, thermite can reach temperatures over 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, quite enough to liquefy steel. We know that open-air fires cannot burn hot enough to melt steel, but metal had melted at the base of the towers. Appendix C of the FEMA report describes sulfur residues on the World Trade Center steel. The New York Times called this the deepest mystery of all. Sulfur slightly lowers the melting point of iron, and iron oxide and iron sulfide had formed on the surface of the structural steel. Sulfur used with thermite is called thermate, producing even faster results.
Well, maybe we're getting somewhere here, because if thermite were used, it would explain the presence of 4,000 degree temperatures Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
It would explain the presence of sulfur. Sulfur's added to thermite to become thermate. It would also explain the next feature that we have of extreme heat evidence, and that is molten iron microspheres in all of this World Trade Center dust. Evidence of ignited incendiaries, all of that was, that applies also to the Twin Towers, by the way, and so does this, evidence of ignited incendiaries in the dust. Well, the U.S. Geological Survey does studies of that dust. What do they find? Billions of previously molten iron microspheres about the diameter of a human hair, previously molten, indicating 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Iron, we haven't used iron in our skyscrapers for 100 years.
Yeah.
Where does the iron come from? And why are they spherical? Well, that's just what aerosolized liquids do when they're aerosolized under explosive conditions, especially. Surface tension forms them into spheres. The EPA says this is a signature component of the World Trade Center dust. We don't know where they came from, but they're not, it's not even World Trade Center dust unless it has all these previously molten iron microspheres in it.
Wow.
Up to 6% of many of these samples are just that, and amounting to about 4 tons altogether. This is incredible evidence that's completely unexplained in the official narrative. But RJ Lee Group, an environmental consulting firm, says they're formed during the event, not before, by the iron workers putting the building together, not afterward, by the iron workers taking the building apart, but during the 9/11 event. Well, this is darn interesting from this detailed study from this environmental consulting engineer. How do we find out where they come from? We could do an experiment. Experiment is the arbiter of competing hypotheses. Let's do one. Let's burn some thermite. What look like sparks, but slowing it down, you can see there are thousands of them. They cool and they fall into the pan as previously molten iron microspheres. So all of that was evidence of ignited incendiaries. Is there any evidence of unignited incendiaries in the World Trade Center dust? Well, yeah, a team of eight international scientists led by Niels Harrit, who will be speaking, by the way, at our conference, awesome, Turning the Tide in Washington, D.C. He will be there. Let's make sure we interview him, Chris.
Most definitely.
Yeah, we just got him booked today, as a matter of fact. Very fortunate. He does studies of the dust. He finds these curious red-gray chips. They thought they were paint at first, but they're attracted by a magnet. So it has a high iron content, much higher than primer paint, which has some iron in it, but it's not attracted by a magnet. So they do some studies, X-ray energy dispersive spectroscopy, and they find aluminum. They find manganese. They find iron. So the ingredients of thermite in the paint chips in the World Trade Center dust, how does that make any sense? They get real curious. They zoom in 50,000 times with an electron microscope. And what do they find? Nano-sized particles of iron oxide, rhomboidal-shaped crystals, and aluminum platelets. Now, that's 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair.
Wow.
That is a problem. This is very sophisticated stuff. In fact, they go, where did this come from? Do we know about this? They do the peer-reviewed literature study, and they find, hey, Lawrence Livermore Lab put this out in 2001. It's called superthermite. Explosive composites based on thermite reactions whose fuel and oxidizer constituents are intimately mixed at the nanometer size scale. You see, when you get the particles that small, the surface volume increases exponentially.
Absolutely.
So you get a rapid, instantaneous chemical reaction. They've engineered an incendiary to become more explosive.
Yep.
And indeed, their differential scanning calorimeter test shows from Lawrence Livermore Lab that at about 850 degrees Celsius, they ignite. Well, that's exactly what the Niels Harrit team samples did. They ignite at 800 Fahrenheit, 423 Celsius. And so, interesting, producing what? That it's thermite, not paint. What else happened when they ignited? They produce molten iron microspheres with the same chemical signature as the molten iron microspheres found and documented by the U.S. Geological Survey and R.J. Lee in all the World Trade Center dust. So we know exactly where those previously molten iron microspheres came from. They came from these red gray chips, as if we didn't know. They're found attached to partially ignited red gray chips, as you see here and here. This is very sophisticated material, not made in a cave in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
This is made only in the most advanced defense contracting laboratories. They've concluded in their peer-reviewed paper in the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal that the red layer is active, unreacted thermitic material incorporating nanotechnology. It's a highly energetic pyrotechnic or explosive material. So this hasn't been contested by anybody else who's put forth their own peer-reviewed paper. We have all the characteristic features here in Building 7 and with the extreme heat that we've been looking at within the Twin Towers. None of these, and it's very uncharacteristic features too, by the way, none of these features can be accounted for in the official narrative by fire, let alone all of them. With additional circumstantial evidence and corroborative testimony, this has become proof of controlled demolition, a body of proof that's convinced 3,600 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation into the destruction of these towers. Many of them appear in our forthcoming series, our ongoing series, 9/11 Crime Scene to Courtroom, in which we have taken the hard evidence of 9/11 crimes to court with the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry and their litigation director, Mick Harrison, and I presenting to a grand jury all of this evidence, and along with our experts. And we'll hope that we're releasing episode 4 this Sunday, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
Yeah. So awesome. I encourage everybody to watch it. 911c2c.org.
All right.
And it's a pretty nice set of breaking down the evidence of World Trade Center 7. We're halfway through Building 7 right now. And then we go into the Twin Towers. Because you've got to ask, again, ourselves this question. If Building 7 was a controlled demolition and it happened on 9/11, is it possible that the Twin Towers are part of, which are part of that same conspiracy, no matter how you look
at it? That's right. That's right.
Could they have been brought down by controlled demolition? Well, look at them. Just seeing the identicality of these two towers, even though they have asymmetrical damage from the fires and the plane impacts, we have upward, outward arching streamers, a geometry of fireworks, freely flying structural steel sections weighing 4 and 8 tons, ejected laterally, clocked by physicists at 80 miles an hour, landing up to 600 feet in every direction. Trailed by what? Thick white smoke clouds. Why are thick white smoke clouds trailing steel members which are not flammable in office fire or jet fuel conditions? Well, I'll tell you. All we have to do is look at the thermite experiment again. Experiment is the arbiter of competing hypotheses. And we can see the aluminum oxide ash that is the other byproduct, in addition to molten iron, of the thermite reaction.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that. So we have to ask, is there any evidence of controlled demolition, of features here? Well, let's begin with the first one. Is there a sudden onset of destruction? Yeah. North Tower standing still, and all of a sudden, it's in uniform downward motion. No jolt. No hesitation upon impact of the cold, hard steel below. Same with the South Tower. It's at rest, and all of a sudden, it's in uniform downward motion indicating that something else is going down there besides a natural collision of two objects. I mean, look at the steel that we're talking about here. It gets heavier and heavier and heavier as we go down until halfway down. The core columns are 52 inches by 22 inches. And they, if infill, can get almost solid steel. Well, wait a minute. We're told that the upper part destroyed the lower part. But the upper part is the lightest part. Is it destroying the lower part? No. Look at it carefully here. I'll make it easier for you. Watch the lower red line. Is the upper part driving the rest of the building down to the ground according to the official narrative? No. It's been destroyed in the first 3 seconds. After that, something else happens, which we'll get to. But you can see that it's telescoping in on itself. It's being destroyed. If it weren't being destroyed, we would have seen it in the photos and the videos. If it weren't destroyed, it would have crushed these remaining columns standing 800 feet in the air for about 6 seconds. But no, they just fall on their own. Well, how do they survive the upper part of this huge pile driver driving down the rest of the building to the ground? And by the way, what does this really look like? Which one's the volcanic eruption and which one is World Trade Center North Tower? You can't tell, hardly. Upward, outward, arching streamers, a geometry of fireworks, freely flying, solid, molten objects, trailed by thick, white smoke clouds. It's not a collapse at all.
Yeah.
Something else is going on here. Yeah, the volcanic eruption is on the right, but they look darn similar, don't they? So we have to ask ourselves, what could have caused that? Well, could explosions cause that? Are there any witnesses of explosions? NIST says no. Here's 156, which are orally recorded, first responders, within a month after 9/11. Professor Graham McQueen read 12,000 pages of testimony, and he documented these, 156 of them. I'm not going to read all of them. But let's look at a few. We felt the ground shake. You could see the tower sway, and then it just came down again and again. You're going to hear this specific order of events. They're hearing something. They're seeing something. They're feeling something before the building comes down. All of a sudden, the ground just started shaking. Felt like a train running under my feet. The next thing we know, we look up and the tower is collapsing. Shook my bones shortly before the first tower came down. I remember feeling the ground shaking. Heard a terrible noise, and then debris just started flying everywhere. I saw flash, flash, flash at the lower level of the building. You know, like when they demolish a building? Saw a number of brief light sources being emitted from inside the building between floors 10 and 15. You saw about 6 of these brief flashes accompanied by a crackling sound before the tower collapsed. I saw low-level flashes. I saw flash, 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 and then it looked like the building came down. An explosion appeared at the very top, simultaneously from all four sides. Materials shot out horizontally. And then there seemed to be a momentary delay before you could see the beginning of the collapse. How specific does this fire chief, Frank Crothers, need to be? He's an expert witness. There was an explosion in the South Tower, one floor under another, when it hit about the fifth floor. I figure it was a bomb because it looked like a synchronized, deliberate kind of thing. Well, interesting. How do we have any, is symmetry here? Is this building coming straight down? Well, the South Tower begins to tip over. Interestingly, it's tipping over at 20 degrees. So we have asymmetrical damage from this part of the building that's falling off. We have asymmetrical damage from the planes, asymmetrical damage from the building, the fires. How in the world then do we get complete symmetrical damage? Just like those firefighters described, like a belt wrapping all the way around the building. how does it make, it makes no sense. And let's zoom in on the leading corner of those explosions. And we can see very clearly that they are individual explosions. They must have been pre-placed in this looped video with about a dozen videos, a dozen explosions. We can easily see them. And this is not a nuclear weapon going off. These are small explosions, thousands of them. And here, a dozen of them. And these are, this is not directed energy weapon weakening the steel that would cause an asymmetrical collapse in the building. You know, if that could happen, wouldn't come straight down either. So do we have any isolated explosive ejections, feature number four? Well, yeah, we have them as far down as 40 stories below the collapse, 60 stories below the collapse. There's no accounting for these isolated explosive ejections called squibs in the official narrative, 60 stories down below. So 20 stories, 40 stories, and 60 stories down below. And here on the left side of the South Tower as it begins to lean right, we can see a dozen of these isolated explosive ejections simultaneously occurring, destroying the structural integrity of this upper section. How fast is the building coming down? Well, once again, David Chandler, physics teacher, and others have clocked it, in this case, at 64% of the acceleration of gravity. That's two-thirds of free fall.
Yeah.
That means 90% of the structure underneath the falling portion of the building has given way. It has been removed. It's not being crushed. If any of these columns were providing any resistance, like in Building 7, they would have slowed this building down.
Yep.
And yet, it's not slowing down. It's not decelerating. It's accelerating faster and faster each second. The definition of acceleration through what? Through 90,000 tons of structural steel, which is 3 to 5 times stronger than it needed to be to support that building. We have 47 massive core columns. We looked at those already. 240 massive perimeter columns, 14-inch square steel tube columns marching all the way around the building. We're going to find out what happens now. What happened to those square steel tube exterior perimeter structural steel sections? For they have impaled themselves into skyscrapers all the way around the Twin Towers, destroying the Winter Garden 600 feet away, destroying the Deutsche Bank building this far away. These sections are mammoth. 37 and a half feet long, 14-inch square columns tied together in threes by three spandrel panels. Mm-hmm. All the plane had to do was punch in this perimeter section. It didn't slice the steel. It punched it in, shearing the four bolts that you see the holes of at the end there. So there's nothing magic about a plane going 500 miles an hour that can't shear bolts like this. So we have the lateral ejection of this steel. They're freely flying structural steel sections weighing 4 and 8 tons, including this one. Whoa, back to forward to. Back to, that's horizontal. How does gravity work again, Chris?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So what's going on here? Out.
Incredible. Forcefully ejected.
What?
Forcefully ejected is the only way to put that.
And to land 600 feet away and, wait a minute, trailed by what? Thick white smoke clouds. Is steel flammable in office fire or jet fuel conditions?
No.
No. It can get a little warm. It doesn't even get hot enough to soften, much less light on fire like a piece of wood. No, not going to happen. There's enough energy here to hurl a 200-pound cannonball 3 miles. So those thick white smoke clouds are aluminum oxide ash, once again, the other byproduct of thermite in addition to molten iron. We have a 1,200-foot diameter, but of debris around each of the towers, actually 1,400 feet, which raises the question, a very important question. If 100,000 tons of steel framing is distributed outside the footprint of the towers, what's crushing the building? What's the mass that's crushing the building? It's not the steel. Most all of the steel, as you can see by looking at what's left at the bottom of the pile, hardly anything. It's not the steel that's crushing the building. Maybe it was the concrete. Because we're looking for about 110 floors, each an acre in size. 4-inch thick, 8-inch thick concrete floors poured on metal decking supported by lightweight steel trusses. We're looking for 110 acre size assemblies here. We don't find 50. We don't find 20. We don't find 10. We don't find 1 acre size or half acre, quarter acre, eighth acre, or 16th acre of floor. Now, in a real pancaking collapse, we have pancakes like in the Bangkok as a result of the Myanmar earthquake. This was only a 33-story building, and yet it's 20 stories tall. You can tell by the size of the people on the lower right. How do we compare that at all then to what happened at the towers? We're looking for 90,000 tons of concrete here. Where did it go? Oh, there it is. The concrete is pulverized to powder in the first several seconds even. That's where the concrete floors are. They're not stacked up on the bottom. How do you get concrete to powderize? Well, at 1,500 degrees, according to American Society of Testing Materials report C856, it says that at these temperatures, 1,500 degrees, the concrete can turn to white powder. Decomposed hydration products, that's the sand, gravel, and cement paste, powder, just like when it was originally made.
Yeah, the lime and everything else.
Yep. All of that can happen at 1,500. What can happen at 4,000 degrees, which is the temperatures we've been talking about, that we have evidence for? The evaporation of steel.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, that's what's happening here. It's pulverized in midair, 90,000 tons, back to 100 micron particles. It's like an ash, they described it as, those who picked it up. And where did it go? It was distributed laterally, like the steel, but even further. A 3-inch thick blanket across 3 square miles of lower Manhattan. Well, wait a minute. If that's true, and we just proved that it is, then what's crushing the building? It wasn't the steel. That was a third of the weight of the building. And it's not the concrete. Another third the weight of the building. That's 2/3 of the weight of each building that's not available to crush the building.
Yeah.
So we've disproven the official narrative, who used all of that weight in their calculations to crush the building. So with the additional evidence of molten steel and iron, persistent extreme heat, thermite incendiaries, we have proof based on the 10 key characteristic features and some very uncharacteristic features of controlled demolition. Fire doesn't create any one of these features, let alone all of them. With additional circumstantial evidence, corroborative testimony, that becomes proof to 3,600 architects and engineers who, again, appear in the crime scene, 9/11 crime scene to courtroom, which, by the way, if anybody wants to support from $10 to $500, at $500, you're an executive producer and Ooh. You're on the credits. And we'd love to have you guys on the credits of 9/11 crime scene to courtroom as an executive producer. And we'll be honored. We'll also be honored by your $10 donation. Absolutely. And so we're going to show this episode at Turning the Tide. And we're looking forward to seeing all of you there, either physically or by live stream, because Clayton Morris of Redacted,
yep,
who's interviewed me, is going to be live streaming this entire 3-day event on his platform on YouTube. And we expect Tucker to come on as well, who's making a documentary, because we'll have millions of views for his documentary too. So we expect to see Tucker come on with Clayton and talk to us at the conference. So this is a huge conference for
it's
all
gonna
of
be
us
great.
In the 9/11 Truth.
It's going to be absolutely awesome. I can't wait for it, Richard. And, you know, a couple things. While you were talking, I was perusing through the nanothermite and just the idea of it being able to be groomed specifically for different results mm-hmm. with different compounds is fascinating. And the idea, once again, that this compound exists. This compound is regularly used for other things, for other products, is fascinating to look into. And when you start considering the fact of, yes, there was steel thrown far beyond the point of free fall, or even catastrophic fall. And if both of those buildings fell because of fire, and because of metal fatigue from fire, if WTC-7 fell because of metal fatigue from fire, Richard, as an engineer and as an architect of steel frame buildings, don't you think that we would have a totally different set of rules and laws when it comes to the regulations of building a steel frame building? Were any of those ever changed after 9/11? Yeah. Are there new regulations yeah. because of that?
Yeah, NIST made some recommendations that were incorporated. However, their structural changes that they recommended, which are the only changes that could keep that might have kept a building from falling at free fall, were not adopted by the International Building Code. And the International Conference of Building Officials knows that their buildings are safe. They don't want more codes. They don't believe the official reports that say this building came down by thermal expansion. It's like yeah. they know this. They do not want to deal with it. Firefighters know this. They continue to march into buildings that have far worse fires than yeah. Building 7 ever did, without fear that the building's going to come down on top of them or the public that they ask to stay in place while they're fighting the fire. They don't want to have to fight the public going up into the building, coming out of the building while they're going up to fight the fire. Yeah. It's a huge problem in yeah. high rises.
Yeah. And you know, once again, you'd think that there would be sweeping massive changes, things like that. And that wasn't necessarily the case. No. You know,
it was not the case at all.
And you marry all those things. The real question, and you know, honestly, not even a question for an engineer, Richard, because it's at least not the motivation of why. You know, the reasoning and the physics of why things happen and why they are explained the way they're explained and why they're explained the way they're explained isn't actual science, utterly the realm of an engineer. and a scientist. But when it comes to motivation, what do you personally think the motivation of this was, Richard? And this goes beyond anything architecturally. This goes beyond anything AIA. I mean, Richard Gage here, speaking as yourself. What do you think the motivation of this was?
We have to look at the at what happened after 9/11. It's quite easy to see who benefited financially. By the way, there's a one-hour presentation on that subject alone by James Corbett, which is excellent. And he stresses it's called 9/11 trillions. Follow the money. So there were bond heists. There were gold heists. This is a multi-layered, very complex operation involving financial transactions that are off the charts, including put options where millions were made betting that the value of the airliners would go down the next day,
mm-hmm.
and they would lose all that money if they were wrong. So the 9/11 Commission, by the way, looked at that and they said, oh, well, this is not in insider trading because Al-Qaeda wasn't involved. Well, who was involved? Turns out to have been Deutsche Bank and others, former CIA leaders. But you also have to look at the incredible geostrategic influences in the Middle East, where Project for a New American Century neoconservatives were brought into the Bush administration with this policy in tow that they had developed in the years before 9/11, stating publicly on their website that they wanted regional hegemony in the Middle East, a vast increase in the military budget. But absent a catalyzing and catastrophic event like a new Pearl Harbor, these goals will likely take a long, long time.
Yeah. And that's why I've always said, you know, believe what you want politically, everybody. Even if this vast amount of data does not stack up to evidence for you, and I could understand that, that doesn't mean that they didn't know something was amiss, that they didn't know something was awry, and that they didn't let it happen. In that true never let a good crisis go to waste mentality, you know, in the idea of, well, this is happening, it's coming. And we'd had attacks on the World Trade Centers before. Like, I was in high school when the first one happened, just before Waco and everything else, you know. So it was one of those, like, it's strange. And when you start looking at the complicity, the rapidity with which things that you'd think if we had a major forensic investigation going on with the destruction of three buildings, two of them by airliners going into them, that we'd have called a halt to moving debris a whole lot faster.
Yeah.
You know, that a whole lot more debris would have been checked out on site, things like that, without it just being hauled off as rapidly as
possible. It was shipped to China for recycling before investigators could get their hands on it and do a proper forensic investigation. This is the illegal destruction of evidence in a crime scene.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is why there's a Lawyers for 9/11 Truth group, because there's tons of things like that are just glaring mishandling of evidence that, hey, like, if that was a murder case, that dude would be set free. He would be walking the streets today. And if this is a murder case, the fact is, yeah, those murderers are walking the streets today, Richard. The people that were complicit with knowledge and did nothing are walking the streets today. And it is something that, you know, wherever you stand politically, justice is not a political thing. Capital J justice is not political. It's not a red, blue, infrared, ultraviolet situation. It is the whitest, most pure of lights out there. And that's the beauty of what you're doing. The things that you are quite literally putting yourself, your career, the letters behind your name and the others that are doing the same, both as lawyers and engineers and scientists, to bring this truth to light, to bring these points of data to light that, yes, point and stack up to evidence. And I regularly on this show, we don't go down a lot of conspiratorial rabbit holes, Richard, on this show. Our job is to demystify and unmuddy the waters. It's to filter the water and show you what polluted the water and what the water is, you know, and quite literally, this is one of those that has polluted the waters of our country for a long, long time. The misinformation and even the misunderstandings of information that people have. This is one of those situations where no, there is enough data that it stacks up to evidence. And I always say that data and evidence are different. Evidence is what you use to keep you out of prison or to put somebody in prison, and never let it be less than that. You know, and there is enough data inside of what you've presented tonight, inside of the presentations by other people at this amazing conference that is coming up. Once again, everybody, feel free to stop on by Eventbrite and get your tickets to the Turning the Tide 9/11 Justice in 2025 conference. It's going to be amazing. Richard, thank you so much for your time tonight. I cannot thank you enough. I can't thank you enough for everything that you do for the families, the victims, for everybody. Before we let you go, go ahead.
You're so welcome. I just want to refer people to the website. You can get tickets here. Richard Gage,
yep.
911.org.
Absolutely. There it is. So, Richard, again, thank you so much for your time tonight. I can't wait to meet you in person at the conference. It's going to be amazing. We'll definitely talk about the coverage, everything else here in the next day or so. I'll be sending you links. So take care. You have yourself a great evening, and we'll be in touch very soon.
Definitely, Chris. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Man, once again, folks, the 9/11 tragedies, the buildings, the data that he puts forth, that once again, I will say evidence, because there is enough data, there is enough founded data, there is enough lab checked data. I mean, heck, like I said, I got the patents for nanothermite right there on our website in the knowledge vault, everybody. So these things are stuff that catalyzes our country. These things are things that change the way our countries, the way our liberties operate. Don't forget, you have freedoms, but those freedoms are sourced from liberties. And those liberties get cut short. And when they get cut short, if we let them get cut short, they're hard to get back. Liberties are hard fought. And when they go away through things like Patriot Acts, when they go away through things like that, it's hard to get them back, and it's hard to substantiate getting them back because you already substantiated giving them away. So remember that. Keep that in mind as we move forward in this very, very important time in history and our country, because it's all around us every day. Doesn't matter whether you're red or blue. There's a reason why the color of this show is purple, and it's not just because that's the color of the crown chakra. It's because that's where we should all be politically. We should all try to be as purple as possible and be looking toward the combination of the red and the blue, be looking toward the white light in the middle, be looking for the common ground with which we can all have our conversations. So thank you so much, Richard Gage. Thank you so much for everything that you have done. Once again, everybody, make sure to stop on by richardgage911.org. That is where you can find your links to get the tickets to the Turning the Tide 9/11 Justice in 2025 conference coming up over 9/11 in Washington, D.C. I cannot wait to go be a part of that when we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody. Oh, also, make sure to stop on by Symposium of the Strange tomorrow night. We will be in San Antonio speaking at the Symposium of the Strange about examining evidence, data, the difference between data and evidence, all that kind of fun stuff. So stop on by, check it out. I will be speaking tomorrow night. When we come back from this quick commercial break, we will be joined by V. Montez. We will be talking about the upcoming Global Pyramid Network conference. And pyramid power, what the geometric shape of the pyramid does, what ley lines are all about, and what her new astrolay is all about, as well as Vibrosol. So we will be talking about that and more right after this, everybody.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much to Richard Gage. I am so looking forward to going to the 9/11 Truth Conference coming up in D.C. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com. Check out their amazing line of products. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used, from seeds to stems to buds to leaves. Every part is used, combusted, reused to make an amazing product complete with terpene profiles and all. I have been using Chris's products for at least the last 6 years, and they are absolutely amazing. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Use the code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two free edibles on your way out the door. While you are online checking out everything from our good friends at True Hemp Science, make sure to stop on by the website of our guest in this segment, Vibrosol.org. That is the website of V. Montez. She is the co-founder of Vibrosol.org, as well as the developer of AstroLay. We will be getting into energetic alignments, ley lines, and specifically pyramid technology and pyramid healing. Welcome to the show, V. How are you today?
I'm well, Chris. Thank you so much for having me today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on. I am fascinated with pyramids. I have been fascinated with pyramids since I was a kid. I want to say the book Pyramid Power was the first thing that I ran across. And it was actually my brother. I got to thank my older brother, Randy. I don't know that I thank him enough in the world for actively exposing me to these kind of things. This was stuff that he picked up at the local library, and then I ended up with my name on the card right after him, typically. But that was my first exposure to some of the studies with pyramid energy and things like that, where it was like, hey, you know, use corrugated cardboard, build a pyramid, put a slice of fruit inside, and put another slice of fruit outside. And it's pretty phenomenal. Like, feel free to do it, folks. If you make an equilateral pyramid and do that, like, it's wild. The fruit inside the pyramid does not go bad like the fruit outside the pyramid. So it's always fascinated me. It's always been interesting. How did you first come to the world of pyramid research and pyramid healing, V?
Well, Chris, my journey started actually in Western medicine, where I spent about 15 years working in fields like emergency medicine, orthopedics, and cardiology. But one of the most eye-opening experiences for me during my years in Western medicine was encounters with amputees. I encountered several who were tapping into self-healing, utilizing the mind, utilizing the biofield of the body, and accelerating their healing in a mind-blowing time, you know. And so it really stuck out to me. And then I got into bones and orthopedics and fractures and breaks. And so I was introduced to bone stimulators, which in Western medicine, we didn't learn a lot about the piezoelectric effect. And to my surprise, we were healing bone fractures and breaks in double the time. And I found it to be so, so fascinating that it really led me down this rabbit hole of wanting to know more. You know, I noticed that with all this accelerating self-healing, that there was definitely more going on out there in our bodies and definitely in the world. And so that's how I started to migrate from Western energy over to the holistic world, let's say. And when I worked in cardiology, I noticed that the heart had an enormous magnetic field. It was, we would do electromagnetic field tests, like stress tests, electrocardiograms, and even Holter monitors. And the fascination of this electric field and how the heart amplified it so far outward, yet again, was another component to this mystery of like, what is happening here? And it all collectively came together when I had a journey to Machu Picchu. Okay. And there I started to experience electromagnetic anomalies while on the sacred sites. And coming in contact with these megalithic structures and other pyramidal structures around the world, I started to realize that there was a relationship between the biofield and our bodies, or our biofield of our bodies, and these highly electromagnetic structures. And the pyramids tend to have been the ones that really stuck out to me. That geometric shape just really captivated me.
Sure.
And even though we may not have all the proof yet about their electrical properties in their entirety, the idea of these ancient structures really started to dawn on me that they resonated in certain energy. And it became a passion of mine to explore how we could bring this knowledge of natural energy and bioenergetics to everyone and making it accessible, showing that everyone could experience pyramids at home. A lot of this this work tends to be rooted in discovering our history, in finding what were the pyramids for. And my curiosity was, well, what can we do with them today?
Sure.
And so I started to integrate bioenergetics with pyramid energy. Over the last 6 to 7 years, I have run countless research projects on how pyramids affect the human body, how it affected the brain waves in the body, how it accelerated recovery levels, just like I saw back in orthopedics, like the bone stimulator, and how it created a resonating amplifier in locations in which we place them.
Yep.
And so my next journey was, well, where do they need to be placed in specific locations around the world? Or could we utilize the environments in which we live in today and kind of change the properties of the pyramid to coincide with the environment in which we live in? And so I started to pioneer a design called Astrolay, which we'll discuss a little further into this. But it was really the question of, okay, how do I orient my pyramid? That's really where it came from.
Sure.
How do I orient it? Does it have to be made from copper? As you mentioned before, when you were younger, they would give out cardboard boxes, you know?
Yeah, no, it was corrugated cardboard, man. It was like, go take the cardboard box that your shipping comes in and cut a piece of a pyramid out of it. Like, it was wild. And the idea that, because I do frequencies for a living, like I'm an audio video engineer. That's what I do. I make binaural beat music. And two things that I have brought up numerous times about the pyramid is, A, it's not a not a tomb. If it's a tomb, whoever is in there, you intended to keep them in there for all eternity. That soul is going nowhere. There's no magic spell by which to have your heart weighed against a feather and move on to the afterlife in that king's chamber where the sarcophagus is. But the idea that it's made out of granite is very fascinating, because when you start looking specifically at the properties of granite, the idea of quartz, feldspar, and things like carbon, you're basically looking at a large capacitor or piezoelectric element. And one hypothesis I have put forth is the two shafts that go, that are slightly offset and slightly different distance with baffles inside of them. Could that possibly have been used as an acoustic treatment to actively make binaural beats inside of the chamber with the passing wind over the top of them, kind of like a straw, to basically tune the chamber to whatever resonant frequency you needed to activate the piezoelectric properties of the pyramid itself? Or to change the person who is in that sarcophagus and elevate their vibration to a different rate, you know? So the idea of using those two things, and piezoelectrics are really interesting. Like a lot of, you were saying when you learned about piezoelectric bone growth, like a lot of people are not aware of that technology, or even the fact that that is the technology that makes braces work.
Right.
Like, braces work because of the slight voltage that your saliva carries and the different probes across your mouth allow it to settle in different areas, making bone grow thicker in one area and pushing your teeth over and straightening them. Like, it's pretty fascinating to think that that is a full-on piezoelectric process that they are using inside of your mouth to make the bone in your teeth grow in different ways.
Right. It is incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible when we start to realize how much of an electric system our bodies are. They literally are devices. We're alive, we're moving. And just to add to that piezoelectric in the teeth,
please.
Dr. Tennant, I believe, is one of the pioneers of this piezoelectric energy research. And he actually had spoken about how our teeth also, when we compress them together, we're releasing that piezoelectric energy to a point where we can even test the teeth to see if we're having microcurrents or electric energy escaping from our teeth. So it is quite a really incredible space. And piezoelectric energy also goes hand in hand with the pyramid energy as well, because they kind of work in a relationship. You know, there's a harmony there between the resonance of the pyramid and its vibration and the stimulation or the mechanical mechanism or compression of, let's say, like crystal quartz, and having that piezoelectric effect happening in a room with a group of people, you know. And as the pyramids of Giza, my theory about the shafts are similar to yours, that it could have been acoustical gateways essentially into the pyramid to help change the resonance. I work a lot with like dielectricity and energy harnessing. And I have noticed that when I create and I build a lot of things, I architect a lot of different types of materials. And so I created an orgone accumulating pyramid that I would sit inside of. And I noticed that when we utilize certain materials, we create that dielectric harnessing that is happening. And the energy tends to stay, or actually it amplifies more with that encasing. And because those shafts are made from granite, and you think about that effect of the water that was surrounding the pyramids, and when the tides would move and it would create that energy and electricity that would go and flow through the granite, creating a similar radiation effect, essentially.
Sure.
From that interaction with the water, the movement, the granite, you know. And so there's so much that really ties into this. And even though it's still a mystery, there's one thing for sure. The pyramids do emit a large amount of energy. It definitely does. If you see the research that's happening over in the Bosnian pyramids, I mean, they are really really making some groundbreaking discoveries over there about the energy that the pyramids amplified. And so, yeah, I'm definitely there with you. Vibration, sound, definitely major elements that are necessary to help stimulate different effects in our environment. And when we apply that to, let's say, like the pyramids we use in our immersive pyramid journeys, we notice that when we infuse the room with certain frequencies, the pyramids do tend to resonate in different, let's say, octaves.
Sure.
And it's really, really fascinating stuff.
Well, let's start getting into that a little bit, specifically the placement of pyramids and how this works with the ley line system and specifically astrolay, the system that you have come up with yourself, V.
Well, astrolay, which is essentially what I did, is I took astrology and ley lines and created a very short name for it. It, like I had mentioned before, it was birthed during my research of pyramid orientation. And I also am a practicing Vedic astrologer, as well as an Ayurvedic. I wouldn't say I'm a practitioner just yet, but I'm right there. And after doing my own research and going on online and listening to a lot of the greats from the past, it began to be this continuous suggestion that the pyramids needed to be oriented to either true north or magnetic north, depending on what they were made from.
Sure.
And as well as the fact that they had to be at a certain angle or degrees. And so depending on whose school of thought you tap into, it usually moves from 51.5 degrees to 51.8 degrees, and that they needed to be at these particular angles. Now, when I started building pyramids, I have zero background in engineering and in creating anything, nor metalwork or welding, for that matter. So when I started making my pyramids, they were not 51-degree angle pyramids. They were lopsided pyramids.
Sure.
You know, it takes time to get to perfection. Yep. And I was very frustrated with the fact that I couldn't get them to angle the way. You know, it was very difficult for me to figure this out. And I worked with different engineers and carpenters and different people to really get that information down and that skill perfected. But in that time, I started taking those lopsided pyramids and like putting them out in my garden and still utilizing them in my research to see, okay, well, they're not 51 degrees. They're not oriented to true north or magnetic north. They're actually, I would orient them to south, east, southeast, southwest, just on purpose to see what would happen. Would they stop working if they're not oriented to these particular?
Sure.
Metals? And actually, to my surprise, they did still elicit an effect to the fruits, to my gardens. What I did notice was that they just had different types of resonance that they were giving off. And I used different devices to try to measure these energies. And they're not perfected methods per se, but they definitely pick up on the fluctuation and changes in the microcurrents in the brain waves. I utilize bioresonance also to test the bodies before and after, our electrical bioelectric systems as well, to see what is happening. And to my surprise, it was astounding, actually. I oriented a pyramid to 62 degrees, and my elephant ears, they doubled in size in 2 months versus the 51.5 degree pyramid, which it took it 4 months.
Interesting.
You know, so different things like this, testing water, doing the water freezing tests and various different tests to see. Okay. And what I came back with was that it matters if you know what it's going to resonate at and what's going to be the outcome of positioning it at this degree or utilizing this material versus that material. And so then I decided to travel around the world to different locations where magnetic energies are higher. And I live in Florida. And so we have hurricane season that comes and visits us every year. And last year, I actually tracked the hurricanes as they were coming in. And they were miles out. That's still Category 1s coming in all the way to Category 4s. And I started testing the pyramids. And I actually invented a device of mine that I'm able to lock the energy into the pyramid. And what was incredible was that as the hurricanes started to get closer and closer, as we know, the magnetic output in the atmosphere started to shift. It started to increase. And so did the readings on the pyramids. And for that reason, I wanted to know, okay, so if we bring these pyramids to another location like Arizona that doesn't have this type of hurricane energy, but they have different types of energies running through ley lines and power vortex centers, what is going to be the outcome of that? And I started to compile the data together. And essentially through Ayurveda, we do dosha testing, and we can dosha test your environment as well. And so that factor was also added into the astrolay. So we started to compile the environment. We started to compile the hemisphere of the earth that we're on. What is the weather like in that time that we're utilizing it? And then to take it the next level, I integrated Vedic astrology into the astrolay system. And that really became breaking because, as we all know, we have a relationship with the stars, with the the cosmos. And, you know, when there's a certain transit that's coming by, like Mercury retrograde, electronics start to go out of whack. You know, communication tends to get a little bit, you know, affected, and people are running from the, for the hills, you know, when that particular transit's coming around. And so what that goes to show is that these astrological movements really do have a strong hand in what's going on in our daily lives. And as we know, the ancient builders of pyramids definitely were fully aware of these astrological transits. They aligned the pyramids and megalithic sites to orient to certain astrological movements and or the solstice, you know, the solstices. And so because of that, I started to incorporate a full body, full environmental, and including ley lined system, which I call Astrolay. And it's in beta 3 now. And so what we're doing is trying to make it really easy to just plug in an address and get your latitude and longitude placements and see what ley lines are moving through here. It's putting in the certain environmental situations that are happening. Is it snowing? Is it dry? Is it humid? Yeah. You know, and what's around us? Are we surrounded by mountains? Are we surrounded by water? Are we on a big piece of limestone in the middle of the ocean in Florida? You know, so all of these factors really, really affect what we're doing when we put pyramids into a space, because the pyramids alone all the resonating amplifiers.
Well, you know? And you know, a lot of people do not understand the way in which their environment like that actively affects their daily life and just their general frequency and vibration. One of the things that we stand behind on this show is targeted individuals, people who claim to be targeted by extreme radio weapons, things like that. Because of my involvement in the community, I have been asked by numerous people to come out to their properties with my 6G scanning equipment, ELF scanning equipment, things like that, to help alleviate family members and their concerns, things like that. They're like, okay, well, if you're somebody who will approach this scientifically. And one of the things that oddly brings people a lot of satisfaction come the end of things, whether we get radio frequencies or not, is the first thing I break out is things like a radon detector. Mm-hmm. Things like a tri-field meter. But even before that, I'm bringing out my my radiation detectors and things like that to see if maybe you're living on a fault line. You know, like I live here in Austin, Texas. We have nothing but limestone all around us. And yeah, water running through limestone itself will create an electric current. Like you add copper pipes to the ground past that, you can get all kinds of really wild radio signals running through your house just by the water running through the limestone that has copper attached to it. You know, and it's really fascinating to think about that and just the way that that affects us, much less how that affects the way one of these pyramids works in a specific location.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. And it is for those reasons that it's important to understand the environment in which you live in. A lot of people disregard electromagnetic interference and pollution.
Yeah.
And they don't realize the inundation of technology and how it really does affect your biofield system. It is something that, because you can't see it and it's a hidden threat, a lot of people just say, well, you know, maybe that's pseudoscience or it's non-ionizing, so I'm okay.
Yeah.
And they don't realize that these low emitting EMFs are really affecting our bodies in such a significant way. I mean, I do also go to people's homes as well to help see how we can clean up that electromagnetic interference and how to become more conscious about how we're sleeping. What are we keeping near our bodies? You know, when we're in that regeneration phase, when we're sleeping or restoration phase. And one of the biggest things, even though Wi-Fi and cell phones and Bluetooth are definitely like on the top of the list, there's also those LED lights, you know, and when you the slow motion camera and you see the strobe effect coming off of these LEDs, it's incredible, you know. And so to think that the brain is constantly picking up on these flickering or these pinging Wi-Fi and then adding in the limestone and the water and the copper pipes and all of that into it. I mean, we have a recipe for interesting.
The especially as somebody that does binaural beat work, the whole reason I got into binaural beats and things like that to begin with was subliminal psychology. I started studying subliminal and abnormal psychology in college for a while, and it fascinated me. Just the simple experiments that were done with flashing light and things like that, and the idea that we don't have laws in this country to prevent people from experimenting on the public, but we do have laws that prevent you from popping a single frame into a video. For advertising, we know subliminal advertising works. We know that 30 FPS, that 30 hertz signal taps directly into our brain. That is the same frequency between 24 and 30 frames per second that our eyes see at, that we process things at. And when you start thinking about the idea of like, I'm a kid of the 80s, I was born in 75, the idiot box, as it was called. It stupefies you. You literally fall into a state of hypnosis after a while. And I hate to sound conspiratorial because my audience knows I'm not really conspiratorial of mind. However, when you just start doing simple frequency math of 30 hertz television is what we had with the old boob tube, the physical tube, we got into LED TVs. Now we're talking 60 frames per second. That means your brain falls into that state twice as fast, folks. That means you are susceptible to any message on the TV like, hey, go check out this medication. You're susceptible to that message twice as fast. It doesn't have to become subliminal anymore when your brain drops into that frequency. And when you're talking ultra HD, 4K and above, 120 hertz, four times as fast you drop into that stupefied state. So, like, you're living it, whether you like it or not. It's literally right there on your phone.
It's there waiting for you.
it's doing it to you, whether you intend it to or not, whether you're watching programmatic advertising or not. You're dropping into that susceptible state. Absolutely. And the prime example of that was a study that we talk about regularly on the show, done by the National Institute of Health, the effects of negative news cycles on the brain.
Mm-hmm.
That came out right after COVID, when we were all locked up looking at a screen like that all day long with that kind of information on it. It does something to your mind. Literally, it weakens your mind. You know, so you have to fight twice as hard to be positive suddenly. You know, things like that. It's very subtle things, but it really does change a lot, V.
It does. It does. And that's something that, like, I personally, with my phone, for instance, I have to try to be very conscious of when I touch my phone, how long I'm touching it for, because it's very easy to find yourself kind of dropping into that. It's an interesting way, because it's by design, obviously, but it's captivating the mind to stay into, like, this zombified type of state.
Yeah.
Yes. You can't break free until you realize, wow, how long has it been?
Even the... One of the shows I talk about regularly in reference to this is a show called Halt and Catch Fire. It was all about the Silicon Revolution here in Texas, the Silicon Prairie, back in the late 80s, early 90s, things like that, the rise of Dell and the internet and all kinds of stuff that happened right here. But one of the things that they get into that they had to tackle as PCs, as they were trying to make PCs, personal computers, trying to take things from let's use this for business use to let's get people into this, was what's called the cooling response. And the cooling response, folks, has to do with that. Come on, man, like, how soon do you start banging the mouse because the machine is not responding as fast as you're thinking?
Right.
And it was literally like, how do we break that cooling response, and how do we get the computer to react fast enough that it keeps people interested and keeps them wanting to be there on that machine? Like, that was an active thing that they considered when building the personal computer, was how do we make people want to spend more time here?
Right. And which is interesting, because now people are time, our attention span is very short. You have but like 3 seconds to really capture somebody's attention nowadays.
Yep.
Where I come from, the old school of thought is we put all the information there, you know, and show the facts, the proof.
When you had time for a thesis statement, V.
And I personally am starting to learn, even like in marketing and just getting information out there, that I have to make sure that I get that nugget of information as soon as you open your mouth, because if you don't,
they're gone.
It's gone. And I won't lie. I personally find myself being one of those people nowadays. If it takes too long, I'm like, too long.
And you know, it's really funny, because I work in the world of high end corporate and things like that. I see and work with very high-end CEOs, that kind of stuff. And I will literally see their activity of on their phone. And their assistants will be like, doesn't matter what it is. If they can't do it on their phone in 30 seconds, it's done.
Right.
Doesn't matter how awesome the idea is. If they can't do it on their phone in 30 seconds while they're on the move, they want nothing at all to do with it. And it's fascinating to see that. Now, how do we, bringing this back to pyramid technology, bringing this back to the work that you do with Astrolay, how do we begin to leverage the use of pyramids, Astrolay, things like that, to begin to shift that frequency of thought in that kind of way? How can we use that to kind of begin to break this modern social programming and return us to a point of grounding without a grounding blanket? Like, good God, man, we have to have grounding blankets now to, like, go take your shoes off and get on the grass again, man.
Right? That good old grounding, getting out there into nature. So, I know that we are definitely the era of indoor people. And you're right. It is difficult to break free from. And I believe that one of the biggest things out here or out there that should be out there is education.
Mm.
I think that if people had a better understanding of what was actually happening around them and to them while they're in this practice of being glued to the phone or having this short attention span, they will realize that, okay, I have to change. Similar to, you know, with your diet, and you want to be you want to be healthier, right? And so what are you going to do? You're going to go into your pantry, or you're going to look in your fridge, and you're going to clear out all the things that don't align with this diet that you want to start. And so it's very similar to that, where if we understand the environment we live in, and that's why Astrolay, and it's like I've said before, it's still in production as far as adding more data to it, because the more I sit with it, the more I realize that I am building this for the everyday person. You and myself, we have a lot of insight on this hidden world of electromagnetism and production and how they use colors and sound, you know, to really affect our bodies. But if we understood on a simpler level how this really is happening and how this is really affecting us, then I believe that we can make a huge change. And electromagnetic sickness is a thing now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Even though it's not a billable thing yet, and it's not a diagnosis code per se in the Western medicine side just yet, it is and it has entered the holistic side, the naturopathic side, which is a start. And with pyramids and with Astrolay, when you sit inside of a pyramid, when you bring your bioelectric body into a pyramid, what is happening is that the pyramid itself is resonating a certain energy. And depending on what it's made from will depend on the resonant energy that it's resonating at and what it's vibrating. But most people or users report that when they get into the pyramid, they are able to drop into a meditative state faster than they would on average. And we have done studies to, on average, it takes a person about 20 minutes to really fall into that deep meditative state if they're not a well-seasoned meditation expert. Yeah. And so with the pyramids, what it does is it changes not only the vibration in your body and how the cells start to vibrate on their own, but it also starts to change the brainwave patterns as well in the brain. And so to see that these structures, when they are built, regardless of their material and their orientation and their size, they do elicit an effect to the human body. And in research studies with 20 participants or one participant, you see this time and time again. It's a repeated effect. And people tend to report also that they feel heat inside of these pyramids.
Interesting.
It's a very interesting thing. And I actually integrate copper alchemy into the pyramid work. And like things like tensor rings and copper rings that I use. And that's a whole other discussion.
Well, but I think it's an important part of this discussion as well, though, because it's one of those, it really does come down to frequency. Yeah. And copper is a strange metal, man. The properties even of verdigris, the green material, the green patina that builds up on copper, like that in and of itself is antimicrobial, things like that. So again, the idea that water running through a copper tube will generate a piezoelectric effect, like that, it in and of itself will carry a small electric current. Like that's a lot of the reason why home pipes have gone to PVC, is because, yeah, you go to wash your hand with hot water and you may actively get electrically shocked instead, because the copper pipe is now inducting from the electrical outlet nearby, you know, things like that. So it's interesting when you start getting into the vibrational properties, the fact that copper isn't magnetic, but it's dipolar magnetic. So if you take a magnet and drop it down a copper tube, it will actively fall slower than gravity allows it. Just weird things like that. It's a strange, strange metal. And one of the memory metals that will like remember its last position.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm so happy that you brought that up, because it's exactly why Copper is one of my favorite. It's my favorite to work with. It's quite fascinating. And when you do add the magnets to copper and like in things such as like electroculture, for instance, we see that effect taking place immediately, you know, because it creates this container of energy by itself, just sticking a copper pole into the ground. And all of a sudden we have a generating field that's happening. And then we can actually close that field in with other components of copper and kind of moving it around on the ground. And that's just, it's a phenomenal metal really to use. And in the work with the magnets, we restructure or reignite, let's say, instead of restructure, reignite cellular effects with the magnets. We integrate the magnets into that. We integrate selenite into this as well, because the selenite also elicits a certain type of vibratory effect when it's in a powder form. And just the combination of that incredible metal with that patina, because I loved patina copper.
Yeah.
For me, I feel is absolutely at its highest potential when it has patinaed. And what I can also tell you is that the patina, because I do bring the pyramids like to the beach as well and to different areas. Mm. And so when we have that patina coming from ocean water versus just, let's say, the rain and oxidation from outside in the rain.
Yeah.
You really feel a strong change in the resonance of these pyramids. And you can see it through microcurrent testing as well.
Well, let's get into that for a second. Let's explore that, because it's always a question. I mean, as a collector of things, stuff like that, you don't want to clean things that you find. You know, you don't want to clean vintage silver, stuff like that. Like the patina helps you age it, that kind of stuff. But there's also, like you're saying, and like I was just saying, there are potential benefits to the patina itself, especially with copper. How often, whenever you have a copper pyramid or any instrument that you're using is copper for grounding, things like that, how often should you clean it? Should you clean it? Things like that. Because, I mean, of course, I've got my crystal friends that are around me all the time. They occasionally get a nice cold water bath, you know, some nice cold water running under them, a nice full moon, you know, something like that, just to kind of cleanse them a little bit. Because, hey, I try to stay good energy, but sometimes I'm holding it because I got some bad juju going on. You know, so how do you go about cleaning the copper? How do you go about treating it? And do you need to physically clean it in any kind of way aside from spiritually cleansing it, so to speak?
Oh, this is actually one of the topics that I'm going to be discussing at the Global Pyramid Conference in September at the Golden Pyramid House. So thank you for asking me this question. Well, like you said, you know, it depends on that school of thought, right? Who's the operator and what do they want from it? And so for me personally, aesthetics isn't necessarily the most important for me, you know, and maybe another practitioner may not like the aesthetic of the pyramid having that patinaed effect. It does give it a little bit more of an agey look to it. But for me personally, the more patina I get on there, the better for me. You know, the more element that I can get from the copper, the better, because some of the copper has treatments on it too. You have to think, like, if you go to like Home Depot and you get your copper, some of them, they do have like a polish that they may have on them. And that also is another discussion about how adding polish and adding different chemicals or different bases to the pyramids or crystals in general will change their vibratory outputs. Right. And so, for me personally, I've cleaned the pyramid before, but I do feel that when it has the more patina to it, it does have a stronger effect, a stronger resonance.
Okay.
Pyramids I leave outside, like in my gardens and stuff, they are completely patinaed. And I noticed that from those versus the ones that are brand new that I put out, the ones that are under the patinaed copper definitely enhance and actually taste sweeter.
Interesting.
fruits, for instance, you know, I notice that they have a sweeter taste to them. And I do add magnets and stuff to different pots and different things to kind of see like what's going to happen to elicit different effects.
Sure.
Although magnets will also help with that. I do, like I've said, it does, the patina tends to hold a stronger type of energy. And I think because it's a natural process of the metal
changing.
And so that component and that output, I think it helps strengthen the metal. I think it helps strengthen the energy. And also, I think it also helps hold in the electricity and the atmospheric energy that we're pulling in with the pyramids.
I was going to say it's almost the fact of the patina is also an artifact of the use and intent. And the intent of while being used in that environment. So yeah, it's picking up the charge of that intent, everything else, the charge of your want of change, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, you get rid of the patina that has been created through that process, even through being in the environment of that process, you're kind of getting rid of part of the intent that the pyramid has put back into the work that you've asked it to.
Yes, I totally agree with that. Absolutely.
So
the pyramids definitely are, they can be owner operated, right? And so It's your intent, like as a pyramid builder, I put certain intentions into the pyramids as I'm making
them,
infuse them with frequencies. I give them a nice selenite wash, you know, like I do add extra properties to it prior to putting like bioenergized sand into it. And so, yeah, I totally agree with that. And I do believe that with that intention that you are putting into that pyramid, every time you sit in it, you know, it is resonating at a specific frequency. Then also we have to take into account astrological transits and movements and eclipses and all of these other things, because that's also going to change what's going to happen as we sit inside the pyramids.
Sure.
Like we do immersive pyramid experiences where each participant sits under their own pyramids. And I base it on astrological components. So I tend to pull the chart of each person that's coming into my environment, because I want to know, okay, what is happening in the sky for these people? Because each one of us has a bioelectric field.
Sure.
And depending on what you believe, whether it's 6 feet out, 3 feet out, we're all interacting with one another. And that energy is going to play on our biofield energy. And the pyramids as amplifiers and resonators are going to amplify and resonate this energy as well.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's important to understand like who my audience is. And if somebody's having a difficult transit, let's say it's not the most optimal time for them.
Yeah.
Then we want to help balance them out instead of placing them in a pyramid and maybe cosmically amplifying certain things that may be happening. Because another thing that the pyramids do is its effect on manifestation. You know, I've spent hours under pyramids trying to do manifestation techniques, trying to see, all right, does the law of the universe apply when I'm sitting inside a pyramid? And what I've noticed is that it actually does. I've had some pretty interesting encounters happen where I can think something after sitting inside the pyramid for about an hour. And then next thing I know, it's the topic of conversation within the next 2 hours, you know? And then that effect continues throughout the day. I can tell you it tapers off at a certain point, but I do notice that there is a relationship with like all of it. It's all interconnected and interwoven together. And the pyramids are just like a vehicle of energy in which you can sit in, step into, and you as the operator can start to manifest change or elicit certain effects that you'd like, you know, based on the components and the conditions in which you're working around with them. So they really are a fascinating.
Yeah, it's almost antenna and filter in the same right. And especially when you're talking about having sessions with people, things like that, V, how do you go about as a practitioner, I suppose, clearing a pyramid after other people's use, you know, so that it's kind of, because of course you don't want to once again get rid of the verdigris or things like that that the pyramid is complementing sessions with and creating on its own as that vibration changes. But I'm sure it's the fact of you want to clear the pyramid for the next person using it, things like that. How do people go about clearing their pyramids that they get from you or that they build themselves?
Well, you can clear it with different methods.
Okay.
And so one of the methods that I personally use is I have a dielectric blanket that I created. And I throw that blanket on the base of the pyramid to bring down the energies and insulate them and try to ground them. Another method that you can use, like a selenite wash, like I was saying to you before, okay, which is grinding down selenite powder. You can put it into a bottle of water of pyramid structured water. So you charge the water under the pyramid, which will change its hexagonal properties. And you can put an intention into that as well, because water is living. It's a living entity. And
yep.
And so I will wash down the pyramids with that as well, to try to bring it back onto a more neutral and coherent state. Another really handy one is frequency. Absolutely.
Okay.
We can adjust the pyramid with frequency, but with a bass so that it vibrates the actual metal. Although it is vibrating while you're playing frequencies in the room, I tend to do it a little stronger so that there's an actual...
Sure.
Vibration felt, you know, by the pyramid. And so those are different methods you can use. Some people will, I don't think that like using like sage and Palo Santo is going to ground the electromagnetic energies. It will clear the space, and it will clear out any stagnant energy that may be lingering around like in the environment in the room.
Sure, sure.
But definitely for like electromagnetic neutralization, those are
okay.
Some of the methods I use.
How about a nice salt bath?
Yes.
Something like that.
You just want to be careful with the salt because the salt will patina.
Yes.
It will enhance the patina quicker. And so for me, I like the patina to naturally form.
Yeah.
I don't try to accelerate that growth. I believe that each pyramid has its time and
yeah.
it picks up on that transition on its own. And so yes, if you're going to use salt water, absolutely. I do salt water baths on my own skin to clear my biofield.
Yep.
You know, and so just make sure you just clean it, just wash off that salt, because it will patina fast.
Yeah. Now we have a few more minutes. Let's get into the conference a little bit. I was supposed to be going to the conference. I don't think it's going to end up happening, sadly. But this is a fascinating conference about tons of pyramid work, pyramid researchers. There's going to be some great workshops about the new possible findings. And I say possible findings under the pyramid. I'm a big believer in there's something there, but we also need to verify that there is something there. The Global Pyramid Network is pretty amazing. I did some digging into it, and it's really, really great stuff. The group of researchers that are a part of it. How did you become a part of the Global Pyramid Network? How did you get invited to the conference? What are you going to be speaking on while you're there?
Well, the Global Pyramid Conference absolutely is going to be amazing. I actually found my way to the Global Pyramid Conference in 2023. And I actually didn't know that there were pyramid conferences.
Yeah, like right.
Until I did. And then as soon as I knew, I booked my ticket. And it was a life-changing experience for me going there. You do meet a lot of incredible people. And you learn a wealth of information. And on top of that, you get to be inside a large golden pyramid. I mean, how often do you get to sit inside of a life-size pyramid building? You know, so it's incredible. And I got involved with it this year. And it is a pleasure and an honor to be able to not only speak at the conference, but I also will be hosting a workshop during the conference as well, bringing these pyramid experiences, immersive experiences to life so that people can experience what we're talking about today, how those pyramids resonate, how utilizing magnets and copper and selenite as well, we'll be having there, and structured water interact with our biofields and how frequency and rhythms really enhance that. And so we'll be doing brainwave entrainments and various different things during the workshop. So it's really exciting. As far as my speaking points, I'm going to be speaking about pyramid energy and pyramid healing for the future, because I am a pioneer and I believe that pyramid energy is still at the beginning of its life expectancy at this point. I think we're just starting to really scratch the surface on bringing pyramid energy into our homes, into our practices. You know, every time I see a pyramid in a practitioner's office, I get excited because I'm like, yes,
yeah,
we got another one. We got another one on our team. and I am excited to be able to share this stage with, you know, the greats, just like Armando May and Filippo Bondi, or even Christopher Dunn is going to be there. And, you know, these are amazing researchers who have been at this for such a long time. And it's incredible, their findings and even confirmations that are going to be coming full circle during this conference. So to be a part of that is very exciting for me. But also their work just goes to, it helps me because it goes to show that whether they are power plants, whether they are acoustical amplifiers, they are resonating energy. And if they resonate energy in Egypt or in Bosnia, they'll resonate energy here. And so with Astrolay, we will be able to create that resonance. We'll be able to have those conditions in which we can place that pyramid in your living room, and it's going to amplify that energy and take away that guesswork. And some lucky people or participants will be able to experience Astrolay live at the conference. So I am excited to bring that, because at this point we are on a beta program, so it's not public. We work with locations. We work with retreat centers and builders. And practitioners who are ready to move in that direction, already they have their space and they want to understand what is the environment in which I'm working in, where is the most optimal space to place my healing beds or my healing chambers, or where should I build this structure, you know? And so I'm very excited about the conference because there's going to be a lot of groundbreaking experiences there, a lot of confirmation. And yeah, you definitely don't want to miss this, because it's not every day that you get to see, you know, these really amazing researchers. And there's so many others that will be there as well that I'm very excited to also share the stage with. And yeah, it's going to be a wonderful time. And
absolutely,
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I'm excited for you guys. I have definitely got to make it out to that next year, because it sounds absolutely awesome. And thank you so much for your time tonight talking about this. Once again, pyramids and pyramid healing, things like that have been on my radar. They are one of the things that truly sent me down the rabbit hole of parapsychology and that kind of stuff, where it was like this fascinated me for a long time, once again, and still does. So thank you very much for your time tonight, V. Before we let you go, one last time, let everybody know where they can go to find out more about Vibrasoul, where they can go to find out more about Astrolay and everything.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And it's definitely been a pleasure to speak with you today and to talk pyramids. It's one of my favorite topics, definitely, to talk about. And
same.
If you are interested in immersive pyramid experiences, or you want to learn about it, you can go to vibrasoul.org, or you can go to thealchemistologist.com, which will lead you both to the same space. And there you can learn more about Astrolay. If you are interested in having your property or your facility mapped out and to understand the energies that run through there, you can go to the Astrolay button there and send me an email. And I would love to work with you. So thank you once again, Chris. I really do appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online, checking out everything from vibrasoul.org. Everybody, make sure to stop on by the website for the Global Pyramid Network. GlobalPyramidNetwork.com is their website. That is where you can click the button right there on the homepage and get your tickets to the Global Pyramid Network Conference this year. It's literally coming right up. It's going to be amazing. While you are online checking all that out, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of our coverage from live events. You can also find your links there to CuriousResearch.org. That's where you can report your experiences. That's where you can find out more about our field observation and encounter log, as well as our remote viewing session journal. You can also go to the Experiencer support page. We have written protocols there for an all-new anonymous group therapy for normal experiencers. So if you're an experiencer of the paranormal, if you have been having problems processing your experience, want to start up a local group that is non-judgmental, non-religious based, things like that, stop on by CuriousResearch.org/support and get your Awakening Together protocols, everybody. It is there for download. You can read what the program's all about. You can start your local groups for paranormal experience support. Thank you so much for your time, as always, everybody. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the difference. Without that open heart, without that open mind, the conversation doesn't happen. Without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.